From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, Mitch Albom, author of the most successful memoir of all time, Tuesdays with Maury, discusses his new novel focusing on the transformative power of music. And soulful Grammy winner Joss Stone shares her first foray into reggae music with a new project. But first, earlier this week, the U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments in a pair of cases that could fundamentally alter two major social issues, affirmative action and voting rights. Professor Melissa Murray of the University of California at Berkeley Law School joined us prior to the hearings to describe the potential long-term significance of the cases. Professor Murray, good to have you back on as always.
Thanks for having me.
Before I jump to those cases, I want to talk about the speech that the country watched President Obama give about these terrorist attacks in light of what happened here in California in San Bernardino some days ago. I guess the ultimate question is, since we're back into this conversation now, how do you do that? Which is to say, how do you protect the American people and balance civil liberties? That conversation is ripe again for debate.
So it's always a sort of fraught question about how you strike the balance between security and liberty. And I mean, again, that was the crux of the president's speech. One of the things that's being talked about is immigration reform, thinking about the visa process, thinking about how we admit people to the United States. I'm sure that's going to be an issue going forward. Immigration reform has already been an issue, and that will only become more intense as this sort of thing becomes part of the debate on that question. The other question, of course, is a longstanding one, and that's gun control. And this is something that the Supreme Court has taken up in past years. But how far do you go into sort of impositions on the Second Amendment while striking a reasonable balance on the right to bear arms? So I think these are questions that are not just in the political zeitgeist, but they're also, I think, in time going to make their way back to the court, in new guises, and guises that are implicated by these recent events.
Yeah. With regard to the issue of gun control, there seems to be this, you know, there's a huge gap, it seems to me, between repealing the Second Amendment and reasonable gun control. Where the law is concerned, how do we get there?
So this is, I mean, it seems like it's an intensely...
Politically, it seems like we can't get there.
It seems like we can't get there. It's a politically intractable question.
Right.
I also think it sort of, you know, reveals sort of the difficulty of a constitutional system like ours. I mean, this is a constitution written in 1787 where the right to bear arms means, I think, something quite different than what it means today, which is not to say that the right is different, but the context in which that right might be exercised is certainly different. Certainly the forefathers didn't imagine the sort of situation that we're dealing with today. So I think that's kind of the question. Sort of, do we hew to this old view of the right and sort of the context in which it was first enacted? Or, you know, is this a situation where we have to take contemporary events into account when we think about what this right might mean in a contemporary society?
Yep. And when it comes to security versus civil liberties, is it your sense that at some point Americans are going to have to accept the fact that there is going to be more encroachment on those rights?
Well, I think there already have been encroachments on those rights. The difference is, like, not everyone is being encroached upon in the same way. So, I mean, when you go through TSA at the airport, if you're a Muslim American, a person of Indian or South Asian descent, you are more likely to be pulled aside.
Yeah.
I mean, this is sort of what we hear in blogs and things like that, and individuals complaining. Not the case if you're someone who's not of that background. So we are already seeing trade-offs between liberty and security. The difference is not everyone is sort of experiencing them in the same way.
Yeah. One stat, right quick, we'll move on, that just struck me in a way that I can't even describe, and I read every day like you do, but since 2011, since 9/11, there have been 45 deaths in this country by terrorist attack. So if you want to put that in the Muslim category, 45 deaths attributed to that. 48 deaths in this country based on white supremacist attacks, like the white guy that walked into the church in South Carolina. 45 terror attacks, 48 white supremacist attacks. You would never know that looking at the debate in this country.
Well, I think part of that is sort of the media coverage of that. And I think, you know, there is sort of a sensationalism about the idea of terrorism. And because of that sensationalism, we don't look critically at the sort of homegrown terrorism that's in our own backyards.
Yeah. I digress on that. I'm still noodling what that really means. And I think the more Americans consider that, hopefully it will change the dynamic and the nature, to your point, of the way my media cohorts are conducting this conversation. I digress on that. Supreme Court, two cases this week. The first is Evenwell.
Mm-hmm.
I'll let you explain what that is. We're talking, of course, about one case, affirmative action, one about voting rights. Let's go to Evenwell first.
All right, so Evenwell versus Abbott is the most important civil rights case you've never heard of.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so this is a case brought by some rural voters in Texas, and they're basically arguing that because they live in a rural, sort of homogenous community in Texas, that their votes are being diluted because in larger urban areas where there are larger populations of voters, the votes of Latinos, for example, carry more weight. And the difference, they say, or the real issue, they say, is how we are thinking about this question of one person, one vote. So for them, one person should equal one eligible voter, whereas historically the Supreme Court has said that one person means just that, one person in that voting district should be equal, which should have equal representation. So we just sort of count persons, whether they are able to vote or not, when we're thinking about how we constitute voting districts. Their argument is that thinking about just the people in the voting district is enough. Instead, you really have to think about who is voting mm-hmm. in that district and how you sort of apportion it. And the reason why this is such a huge case, even though you've never mm-hmm. heard of it, is because this will change, I think, how we divvy up the population when we think about statewide elections. It's only a statewide case, mm-hmm. but some have argued that its effects may have lasting repercussions for federal elections. But the idea here is that if we switch, as the petitioners here are arguing, to a vote-eligible voter model rather than just a population model, we're going to be throwing a lot of votes toward rural, more homogenous racially homogenous areas of the country and areas that skew largely toward the Republican Party.
That might have an impact on this gun control debate we were talking about a moment
certainly,
ago.
Certainly, certainly.
Yeah. In what way specifically?
Well, so if you think it's sort of stereotypically
sure, sure.
that the rural areas of the country are more likely to be more amenable mm-hmm. to gun rights, less amenable to gun control, that's going to have a huge impact if, in fact, a case like this allows more power to be devoted to those areas where there are more rural voters, more racially homogenous voters. If you're someone who thinks that immigration reform is really important and you're worried about the effect of Latino disenfranchisement, you would want to hew to the older current model of voter representation, which is one person, one vote, and doesn't focus on eligible voters, but really thinks only of the number of people in each district.
So that's the voting rights case. The other case is the affirmative action case.
Yes.
Fisher 2.
Fisher 2.
Fisher the sequel.
Yes.
Tell me more about this.
So in order to understand Fisher 2, you have to understand Fisher 1. Mm-hmm. So Fisher 1 is a challenge that was brought in 2013 by Abigail Fisher, who complained that she hadn't been admitted to UT Austin, Texas's flagship undergraduate institution. She's arguing that Texas's admissions policy, which first takes all of the 10% of high schools in Texas and admits those students to UT, and then uses the remaining 20% of slots that are available and thinks about admission on a holistic kind of level, admitting students based on their family's socioeconomic background, based on work experience, other accomplishments. They use that sort of holistic review to fill the last 20% of slots. She argues that because race is one of the factors that can be used in those holistic review procedures, that the policy is unconstitutional. This went to the court in 2013. There's a lot of discussion that's happened and since then about what the court did. The court never really issued a ruling on the merits and instead kicked it back to the Fifth Circuit, saying that they hadn't properly applied strict scrutiny, which is the appropriate standard for any race-conscious admissions program, said that the Fifth Circuit should go back, should apply strict scrutiny properly, and then we'd see where we'd end up. So the Fifth Circuit went back, they did that, they upheld Texas's plan as they did before, and now Abigail Fisher has appealed to the Supreme Court. The fact that the court took this case is a huge issue because it means that the fight that was still happening in 2013 continues. And the backstory, according to Joan Biskupic, who's a longtime legal correspondent in Washington, was that the court was all set to strike down affirmative action in 2013, and Justice Sonia Sotomayor issued a blistering dissent that was circulated among her colleagues. And in order to sort of mute that dissent and get her back on board, they brokered a kind of compromise that forced the court to kick this back to the Fifth Circuit. In the ensuing year, in 2014, Justice Sotomayor had another opportunity to think about affirmative action and again issued a blistering dissent in Schwede versus BAMN, the Michigan case. That didn't sit well with the Chief Justice, who was one of the people that she took issue with in that dissent. And now there's now another set of four votes to hear Fisher 2 again. So that's sort of the backstory of what's going on. There are three things that I think could happen in this case. One is that the court does nothing. Unlikely. I think it's unlikely. They could say that the Abigail Fisher, who has since graduated from LSU, doesn't have standing, and this is not a right case or controversy. That's not what's going to happen. They could take a kind of middle approach, which is to strike down Texas's program on the ground that the Texas Top 10% plan, which is a race-neutral plan that just sort of takes the top 10% of all Texas high schools, is enough to promote diversity in education. They might. Yeah. I think they could, depending on the coalition of the justices. And then, of course, the sort of nuclear option, which is to eviscerate affirmative action across the board. I think that's what some people on the court want. Yeah. I think there's definitely four votes for that.
Yeah.
Once again, Anthony Kennedy is the swing voter here. Elena Kagan is not taking part in this case because she defended the Texas program in 2013 as Solicitor General, or in earlier lower cases as Solicitor General of the United States. I think because she's out of it and there are only eight justices, I think it's a lot harder for the right to kind of cobble together a convincing majority to eviscerate affirmative action altogether. But I am not a prognosticator of what the Supreme Court does, and I would be out of a job if I did.
Yeah.
But I'm hoping that maybe the middle road is what happens, and this just sort of ends with Texas's own plan.
Yeah, my sound effects notwithstanding, I had forgotten that Kagan is not sitting.
She's not in this one.
In this case, so maybe
maybe this lives to see another day, but this will definitely, if it doesn't happen here, I think it's going to come back to the board. And this is why elections matter.
Yeah.
I mean, we have an election coming up. The composition of this court, so many issues depend on that going forward.
Yeah. I could say something else, but that's a perfect note to end. So I couldn't agree more with you on that. Thank you for coming back to see us.
Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Mitch Albom has many titles: nationally syndicated columnist, radio host, screenwriter, playwright, author. But of all those, he's best known for writing the highest-selling memoir of all time, Tuesdays with Maury, one of his six consecutive New York Times bestsellers, I might add. His latest work is The Magic Strings of Frankie Presto, a novel that weaves its protagonist, a Spanish War orphan raised by a blind music teacher, through the musical landscape of the 20th century with a unique narrator called the Voice of Music. Brilliant idea. Before we start our conversation with Mitch, this clip to set the stage for this unique story.
Then the way he died was so mysterious.
When he was performing, he started to rise up. It's the perfect death for Frankie Presto. Who was this guy? Was he one of us? Did he come from some other place?
He was an orphan in Spain.
Being in Detroit, looking for his mom.
He came to New York and broke all kind of records.
He just sticks his head in the door. And our first reaction was, hell, he is fine.
Every time I know you've done me wrong, here you come sing your old song.
So I'm sure some folk in the audience just got lost because I mentioned this is a novel. It is a fictional story. But these folk in that brilliant rollout are real-life people. What a brilliant idea to market, promote, get us to be interested in who Frankie Presto was. Whose idea was this?
It was my idea.
Yeah.
But it doesn't surprise me because it's a book written about the power of talent, particularly the power of music, to influence people. And I've been blessed in my life to know a lot of musicians and get to know them, a lot of whom were in there.
Sure.
And when I asked them to participate in the book, not only did they participate in the book, they took it like to a whole other level. So they made these videos as if Frankie Presto was real, like Forrest Gump.
Yeah.
And they even recorded a soundtrack album to it, which they did songs that I fictionalized in the book, so they basically remade songs that never existed, which I'm pretty sure has never happened before. But it's all for a love of music that we all share.
Yeah. So who is Frankie Presto? Was Frankie Presto?
Well, Frankie Presto, I should set it up. The book is told by the voice of music, the voice of music itself as a talent. And it explains right from the start that when you're born, you come into the world, And before you even open your eyes, you actually see a wall of brilliant colors. And those colors are actually all the talents that exist in the world. And with your little fist, the first clench that you take with your fist, you grab the talents that actually innately most appeal to you, and those become the talents that you have for your life. Mm-hmm. Frankie Presto grabbed two massive fistfuls of music and subsequently becomes the greatest musician to ever walk the earth because he took more music at birth than anything else. And so he's this fictional musician who has a tragic early life. He's an orphan, as you mentioned, born in Spain. He loses his parents. He bounces around from person to person. And sort of as a payback for that, he's given a guitar when he's about 9 years old with six magic strings that over the course of his life can actually change six lives with his playing. And when it happens, his playing is so affecting and it changes someone's fate that the string turns blue and then withers away and is gone. And on top of it being a big tour de force and a Forrest Gumpy zealot kind of story, it's also a metaphor for how we are able to change other people with the talents that we are given in life if we're true to them. We all sort of get our own blue strings to change somebody.
Yeah, there's a lot here, and I want to unpack some of it in the time that I have with you. Let me start by asking, for those of us who know you and know your past, you're a piano player, but you made Frankie a guitar player.
Yeah.
Why?
Because you can't tote a piano around wherever you go. I mean, he wanders all over the globe.
Yeah,
without
he'd
be like, here was Frankie pushing his piano across Spain. You know? Kind of, that just didn't work.
Simple enough. Okay, I guess I was asking for that. I got it. Okay.
Right.
what does this novel say to us first about music, about the power that is pregnant inside these notes?
Well, I believe, having been a musician, that's where I started, that there is a language that is spoken through music that is on a whole other level. You know, you can take two people from across the globe, totally different in background, in ethnicity, in religion, in economic situation, and you put them as close as you and I are and play She Loves You, Yeah, 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 or something, and they both start tapping their feet. Now, why is that? You know, there's something that speaks to people on that level about music. And the universality of that is also reflected in how people get together to play music. So having been in many bands, a line in the book that I'm sure you're familiar with, it repeats often, is everyone joins a band in this life. Some of them play music, but everyone's in a band. You're in a band. This show is a band. Your family's a band. You know, your workplace, your school place, the army. And everybody has a certain role. Some guy's the lead singer. Some guy has to keep the steady beat. Some guy gets stuck with the rhythm chords while someone else gets to be the lead player. But the dynamics of how music works within when people come together to play it is very much similar to the dynamics of human interaction.
And but every band breaks up eventually.
And every band breaks up for three reasons.
Yeah.
Divorce, death, or difference of opinion, right? And that's pretty much the way that life goes, too.
Yeah. When I had this come across my desk, because I know you'd have known you, I think I'd call you a friend.
Absolutely.
I hope you'd call me a friend.
I hope you would.
All right.
Otherwise, we got to talk about something. What's been going on, damn it.
I was anxious to see when I discovered who the character Frankie Presto was, what kind of lyrics you'd put in his mouth. It's one thing to be a performer, but I wanted to know what kind of lyrical content you were going to put in his mouth. Tell me about that part of the book.
Well, it's interesting that you ask that because his real talent is playing the guitar. And he comes from the tradition of Spanish guitar. He's taught by a blind Spanish guitar teacher in the tradition of Francisco Torrega, who was the father of modern classical guitar. He influenced Segovia and all the people that came after him. So his real gift is playing the guitar. He has all these adventures along the way. He's in Duke Ellington's band. He convinces Little Richard to record Tutti Frutti by accident and launches his career. He interacts with Hank Williams. And at one point, he's with Elvis Presley as his backup guitar player. And one night, Elvis gets called to the Army to talk to them. And Colonel Parker doesn't want to cancel the show. And because Frankie looks like Elvis and can sing like anybody, he lets him be Elvis for the night because those shows were crazy. People were in the stadium. And he gets out and he pulls it off, and that's one little adventure. But what happens to him is he gets a taste of fame. And he hears girls screaming for him and just by singing, and he becomes a pop star himself, a rock and roll star for a couple of years. And they convince him, you don't need your guitar. Just get out there and sing and be sexy. And so he puts his guitar symbolically in the closet. And that's when bad things begin to happen to him. So the songs that he writes and all the rest of it are secondary to his guitar playing. And he goes downhill when he just focuses on being a pop star, and then eventually has something terrible happen to him at Woodstock, and he disappears for 20 years and becomes this recluse. And, of course, when he becomes a recluse, the whole world starts looking for him, and they start chasing after him. So the lyrics that I put in at the beginning when in his songs, at first they're very innocent. I want to love you, and that kind of stuff. Then he writes a song for the woman who he loves who leaves him. And that's called Our Secret. And then finally, at the very end of his life, he writes a song that it's just brokenhearted because his wife has died. And he says, the clouds lay claim to a moonless sky. You were gone and I am here, which to me encompasses loneliness as best as I could lyrically put it. Blessedly for me, I actually got real musicians, friends of mine who like the concept of a book about music, of which there are not very many fictional books about music. You can count them on one hand, the well-known ones. And they went out and they recorded these songs. They took my words and they took the title and they took the year it was supposed to have happened and they went out and they made these songs. And I had a chance to watch them come to life as if they were real songs. And each person got them beautifully. John Pizzarelli did the final one, the great jazz guitar player. Ingrid Michaelson did the ballad. Matt Kearney did the rock and roll song, and so that's, you know, no one's asked me that since I leave it to you, Tavis. You know, everyone has always asked me, you know, so where'd the idea come from? And you asked about the lyrics. That's really something.
Thank you. When you are writing a book like this, in the century that you're writing it in, obviously he said earlier, he's kind of he's Forrest Gumpian, in the sense that he's moving through time. Did the scenes come to you? Not by scenes, I mean the moments that you wanted to put him in based upon what was happening in that century.
Yeah. Well, I had to do a lot of research. This is the first book I hired a full-time researcher for. I've had people help me on part-time basis before, but I had to go over to Spain. I went into the church. I had to talk to translators in Spanish to find out everything that went on there. And then all the stuff that happens in America, from what studio Little Richard recorded in to what car Hank Williams bought that he ended up dying in, to where did Duke Ellington and Django Reinhardt play together because he's with him. I either did all that research myself, my research work with me, researcher worked with me, and a lot of it I knew because I'm just fascinated by this anyhow. But it is the most historically accurate book I have ever written. It's like doing nonfiction, except I plopped Frankie Presto in the middle of it. So there was a lot of work, but it was fun work for me because I got to find out how many trombone players were in Duke Ellington's band, and you know what was the Grand Ole Opry called, and what did it look like, and where was the entrance in 1953? You know, that kind of thing.
You titillated me a moment ago when you suggested that there have not been. I've been sitting there thinking. I could have asked it the minute you said it, but I wanted to take 2 minutes while you were talking and answering that question to think about this before I raised it, which is why there haven't, in fact, been more fictional books about music. I was trying to think of a few in my head before I asked this question, but why so few?
Well, I think it's because it's very hard to put into words what music does to people because it is an audio, medium. And so how do you describe a note? How do you describe harmony other than using the words for notes and harmony? Now, because I was a musician first and a writer second, I took a stab at it, and hopefully a few times I got some paragraphs right that can create it, the magic of it for people. But most people shy away from it. It's hard to write about music, just as it's probably hard to, you know, write music that necessarily encapsulates words. I mean, you can get all beautiful words don't always fit to music. They're a little too clunky. They're a little too awkward. The sentences don't work. The mediums are very attracted to one another, but also like magnets, you know, they get too close and they start to bounce off. So I've tried to do it in Frankie Presto.
Quincy Jones, Q, tells me all the time, every time we talk, at some point you talk to Q long enough, this is going to come up in conversation. He's going to raise this point at some place in conversation. Whether you talk to him for 5 minutes or 5 hours, he will eventually get to this end. It always makes me think, every time I hear him say it, which is that there have always been, there are now, and there will always be the same number of musical notes. There are no more.
That's right.
And yet, what people have done with those notes is endless when it comes to the stuff they've created and produced.
Right.
And I thought about Q's admonition, or Q's, you know, statement when I got a chance to get into your text, because it reminds me and underscores for me that very point, that there are This is the number of notes. Mm-hmm. And look at all that's been created by those notes. Right. What do you make of that?
Well, first of all, he's 100% right. Yeah. And secondly, I think the music is as elastic as the human imagination. Mm-hmm. So the greater our imagination gets, the greater music will grow. No one could have imagined rap music mm-hmm. 50 years ago, that it would become what it is. Electronic music would have been a pipe dream. Mm-hmm. But it is. These are legitimate and masterful forms of music as practiced now, and I think it'll just continue to grow. It's why I was wondering when you said Quincy. First of all, Quincy Jones is an absolute hero of mine. If I ever got a chance to meet him, I have never met him.
We got to make that happen.
I'd be down on the ground.
We got to make that happen.
I'd be doing the not worthy thing.
He's a great guy.
I was wondering the quote you said, because another quote that an equally talented musician, Duke Ellington, was famous for having said was, "Music is my mistress, and she's a jealous lover." Mm-hmm. And I read that when I was very young, and I realized, and a lot of the musicians I know. This is why music often interferes with their personal lives, mm-hmm. because once you are infected with it, nothing will satisfy you the same way, mm-hmm. and it will always pull you back, and it will always be there for you, and it will never leave you the way that human beings can or whatever, and no matter who you fall in love with, and music says this mm-hmm. as the narrator, you know, no matter who Frankie Presto, no matter who crossed his bed, no matter who he's... I always knew I had him, you mm-hmm. know, because he was mine. Mm-hmm. He was full of me.
What kind of narrator is music?
Proud, mm-hmm. Sensitive, haughty, curious. It was such a liberating thing to write as a spirit, because you're not stuck in the first person of a mm-hmm. real human being. You're not stuck in that dispassionate third person narrative. So I got to ask all these questions and speak as I imagine music would speak. For example, there's a point where he says, you know, what is with this money thing? Mm-hmm. I don't know what it is. I've never touched it. All I know is it has taken away so many of my best artists, mm-hmm. you know, who have chased after this money. Why does money matter? I matter. Mm-hmm. What is this stuff between your fingers? Another point he rails against when Frankie gets involved with Woodstock and he's involved with drugs and things mm-hmm. like that. And he says, why do people think that you're going to find me at the bottom of a bottle or the end of a needle? Mm-hmm. I'm already inside you. Why would I hide from you and make you go through that to get to me? And of course, ever since Charlie Parker, you know, jazz musicians have been, and many other musicians after that, and many rock and roll guys did the same thing. They think, well, he was great and he did drugs, so if I do drugs, I'll be great. That's not the way mm-hmm. that it works. You know, the music's inside you or it isn't. It isn't in that needle. But I got to express that as a voice of music. So music is it thinks it's the best talent.
Yeah.
It says the other talents are good, but yeah. I'm the best. And if I were music, I think I'd speak that way too.
Yeah. You mentioned Woodstock. You mentioned the drugs. You mentioned Charlie Parker. Charlie Parker didn't survive. There's a long list of those who did not.
Right.
Frankie survived.
Yeah.
Why? I mean, the simple answer is you got to close the book some sort of way.
You need to close. Yeah. You need the character.
Yeah.
But why did he survived that episode.
Yeah, well, because you can't really teach the lesson if it ends halfway through.
Right.
You know, he paid a price mm-hmm. for his addiction, and he paid an even bigger price. What preceded his addiction was his walking away from his talent. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to bring that around full circle. Because with all of my books, although I hope I write an entertaining story, I always try to have a theme mm-hmm. or some kind of lesson. Ever since Tuesdays with Maury and Five People You Meet in Heaven, I mean, those are books that have stories and narratives, but hopefully when you're done reading them, something sticks with you. Well, what I wanted to stick with after this was over was that we live in a world where our talents, yes, everybody acknowledges talent, but for the most part, we only celebrate a handful of them. Mm-hmm. The talent to be a startup artist, mm-hmm. the talent to invent a computer or something technological, or the talent to sing and win a reality show. You know, these are the great talents, mm-hmm. or if you can act, if you can be...
Athletics, of course.
Yeah, and sports. Yeah. But if you don't have that handful of talent, it's like, well, whatever your talent is, just isn't. You didn't get mm-hmm. lucky with the good one. And that's not true. I wanted to be a musician when I first came out. Mm-hmm. I dreamed of being a musician. I had paid no attention to writing. I didn't write a thing through college. But when music didn't work for me, I kind of failed at it, you know, economically, whatever, and I had to try something else. I kind of fell into writing, and it turned out that that's where I belonged, and that's where I could make a difference. And I've actually had people who said to me, you know, Tuesdays with Maury changed my life. Mm-hmm. I've had many people say that. And at first I thought, a book can't change your life. What are you talking about? But then over time I came to realize, well, books music, whatever your talent, however it influences someone, can change your life. You may have had a conversation with somebody, made them think about something, and because you're very good at what you do, you made them think differently when they left, and you altered their path a little bit. A nurse takes care of a patient in a hospital and does so with such comfort and care that when they get better, they say, you know what, I want to heal people too, and a life has been changed. Now, these talents may not be LeBron James's mm-hmm. talent or Beyonce's talent or Duke Ellington's talent, but they are your talent. They're the ones that you grabbed with those two little fists when you came into the world, and yeah. those are your blue strings, you know? That's mm-hmm. what you're here to do.
If I said to you, the problem, though, is, while I love the text, we live in a world that doesn't celebrate talent. It celebrates mediocrity. Mm-hmm. It celebrates people singing in auto-tune. Mm-hmm. It celebrates people lip-syncing. It celebrates your curves and your looks and mm-hmm. It celebrates your family heritage and who you know. If I said to you that the world really doesn't celebrate pure, unadulterated talent the way it used to, it's all this, we're skimming talent.
Well, first of all, I don't disagree with your question or your premise, but I might disagree with the noun.
Okay.
The world, what's the world? Media?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I don't look at the world that way.
Fair enough.
I look at it, if I'm sitting across from you and you're playing me a classical piece, Lagrima by Francisco Torrega, which is the central piece of that book, mm-hmm. not Rock Around the Clock, mm-hmm. you know, not, you know, a modern
Beatles,
song.
Yeah, sure.
Right,
yeah,
not
yeah.
the Beatles.
Yeah.
Then that is being celebrated. If mm-hmm. I say to you, God, that's beautiful, and mm-hmm. it's just me and you, why do I need the world to call attention to it? So it depends on who's celebrating what. Mm-hmm. And it's not an accident that it's only when Frankie goes back to his playing and turns inward mm-hmm. and just plays for his wife. And in fact, without giving away too much of the book, the Magic Strings of Frankie Presto is actually the name of a bootleg mm-hmm. that somebody recorded that he didn't know about when he was in a studio and he just was playing everything he ever learned to his little girl and his wife. And he said something to her about those strings are magical because the strings were magic. And the guy wrote the Magic Strings of Frankie Presto and put it on a shelf. And later somebody stole it, and then it became a bootleg. And everyone mm-hmm. in the world had to get it who was a guitar player. And they all thought it was because of his playing. And in the end, towards of his life, he tries to get it back. And you read along and you figure, well, he wants it back because he doesn't want people selling it in his name mm-hmm. or whatever. And that's not it at all.
Yeah.
He wants it back because the tape contains him laughing with his wife and his daughter. And he wants to hear that again mm-hmm. at the end of his life. So mm-hmm. to him, the same thing that was celebrated mm-hmm. by the world for one reason, was celebrated by him for some totally different one. Yeah. So it is possible to celebrate real art. It just has to be a smaller audience sometimes.
Is music still pregnant with the kind of power to make the kind of difference in the world today that it once did?
I think so. I think in some ways even more than before as the world becomes louder and noisier and more complicated, you know, there's a line in the book that says, all humans are musical, why else would the Lord give you a beating heart?
Mm-hmm.
And we all have that in common, you know. And haven't you ever been like in a waiting room or airport lounge and some really catchy beat comes on, a song, and you look around and people's feet, you know, like, and you say, well, that guy, that yeah. fat guy over there,
yeah.
and that kid over there, and that tourist over there, and they're all why?
Yeah, yeah.
Why? There's something that can change us through music.
That's my favorite line in the book, that beating heart line.
Thank you.
It's a powerful line. Let me close on this note. I think it's maybe the last question. I don't mean to proselytize here, but I couldn't help but think about this the minute I got the book. And I've given speeches about this around the world. One of my favorite parables in the Bible is the parable of the talents.
Mm.
And for those who never read the Bible know the story about the parable of the talents, go find it. There are two versions, one in Matthew, one in Luke, as I recall. But two versions of a parable called the parable of the talents, which leads me to ask you, what do you hope the book speaks to us, speaks into us, about how we use or abuse our own gifts, our own talents?
Right. Well, if I remember that correctly, the parable, you know, the lesson you walk away from it is you don't squander it and you don't just let it sit there and, you know, you do something with it.
That's right.
And we have all been given that chance. You know, in the book, it's a fictional thing where you grab what appeals mm-hmm. to you. But what appeals to you for a reason. You have that ability. And don't be afraid to maximize it. Don't be afraid to utilize it. And don't be ashamed of it or try to say, well, I don't want to be that. I want to be this.
Mm-hmm.
If it feels natural and you have that gift, be as good as you can at the thing that you were given, and you may find the satisfaction that you're looking for rather than chasing somebody else's talent that for whatever reason you didn't grab when you came into the world, wasn't meant to be for you. And this speaks to a whole larger thing. If you can accept what's meant to be for you, be satisfied in a simple sense, your life is infinitely more at peace and happier than if you're constantly chasing the colors that were never meant for you in the first place.
You've hit that parable on the head. And the last thing about that is that if you pursue exactly what you said, the gift that you have been given, you become the best at that, as has happened for you and me and anybody else who's done it. It makes room for itself. It opens up other doors to do other things that you never thought imaginable. That's because you perfected that one gift.
That's right.
That you had.
You're absolutely right.
But I digress. The book from each album is called The Magic Strings of Frankie Presto. He's done it once again, six consecutive number one New York Times bestsellers, and this one is no less good than the others. Mitch, always good to have you on the program, and congratulations, my friend.
Thank you, Tavis.
Good
great
to
see you.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Grammy-winning singer-songwriter Josh Stone has sold more than 12 million records worldwide since her breakthrough debut album, The Soul Sessions. She's out now with a new project titled Water for Your Soul, which has spent an impressive 13 weeks toward the top of the Billboard reggae charts since it debuted at number one. Before we start our conversation with Josh, here's a clip from one of the songs on the project. It's called Stuck on You.
You don't like my mind. It ain't changing. I can't care if you're here or there. It's all right. I'm just saving my heart. Just leaving me with you ain't smart. See, the deeper I fall, the faster you run away.
Let's talk about this album, reggae.
Yeah.
I mean, since the first time I heard you a decade ago, there was no doubt that you could sing anything you wanted to sing.
Thank you.
But this is a pleasant surprise.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Why this and why now?
I just enjoy all different styles of music, I think. And I love reggae music.
Yeah.
I guess it's been part of my food since I was a little girl.
Mm-hmm.
We listened to a lot of soul music. There was a lot of James Brown, Anita Baker going on.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was Lynton Kwesi Johnson and Bob Marley. You know, that was like, my parents listened to that a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I just liked it. And then I spent some time with Damien.
Yeah.
Who?
Damien Marley.
Yeah. Oh, who's
son,
actually
son of Bob.
Co-wrote. Yeah, son of Bob.
For those who don't know, yeah.
Wow, he's amazing.
Yeah.
So we wrote a few things
right.
that are included on the record. And he encouraged me to go forth and make a reggae record.
Right.
But it turned more into a world music record, I think.
Yeah.
We've got a lot of reggae, but we've got a lot of world influence and R&B influence on there too.
Yeah.
It's just nice to not be stuck.
Yeah.
You know, to just be free musically.
I want to come back to that notion of being stuck and being free in a moment here.
Mm-hmm.
Before I move to that though, what is it about reggae, about the style, about the sound, about the beat? When you've been here before many times, and we've talked about your love of R&B. I get that. And even gospel, for that matter, I get that.
Yeah.
But what is it about the reggae sound that titillates you?
You know, it's a different thing to the R&B and soul world.
Yeah.
Because I noticed that I had to sing very differently on the reggae tunes.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's not so free vocally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, you just sing. Just sing it. Don't don't mess with the melody and go off ad-libbing, because
right.
it will ruin the reggae vibe.
Mm-hmm.
The reggae thing seems much more, like, solid and simple and playful and fun, and it uplifts you a bit, you know? It's like party music to me.
Yeah.
That's the type of party I go to anyway.
Yeah.
I don't really do the clubs, so, you know, like, that's... It just makes you feel good.
Yeah.
It's like a happy feeling, even if it's a sad song.
Yeah.
So.
You mentioned being free and not feeling stuck, not feeling boxed in.
Right.
Pretty common knowledge now that you got a huge disagreement. I'll be generous about this. I won't call it a fight. A huge disagreement with your former label. I won't even call their name.
Okay.
But you saw things differently.
Yeah.
In retrospect, what was that about, and how important has it been now to have your own record label? This is your third project, I think. Third on your own label.
Yes.
So you found that freedom.
Yeah.
But for such you're such a young artist to have had. I mean, I see artists all the time who have those fights, those disagreements as their career unfolds.
Yeah,
but
it happens.
You had that such a, so early on in
had
your career.
Had it pretty early.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's the takeaway from that, having it so early?
I think it's helped me a lot, for sure, in getting it out the way. Because now I have a whole life to live, and I am free musically, for sure. Mm-hmm. I'm free in every way.
Yeah.
But musically, I wasn't for a minute. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, I'm a bit older now. I think we had this disagreement maybe 5 or 6 years ago.
Right.
And I was really irritated. I was very annoyed. Mm-hmm. There's a song on this record called Wake Up. And Damien actually is on that one. And it shows you just how annoyed I was. But I didn't recut it because, and I wrote this at the time.
Yeah.
I didn't recut it because I don't feel like that anymore.
Right.
Now I just feel like I actually needed that time with that label. I learned so much from being with that label, from singing the songs that I actually didn't want to sing. I learned a lot from doing that.
Right.
That's important, sure, that you do that and that you find a way to make yourself like it or change it a little bit. You know.
Plus, I would assume when you're forced to do what you don't want to do,
you
find out what you want to do.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I just want to be free. So there's lots of different styles on this record, and some people might pick it up thinking it's going to be, you know, Right to Be Wrong and Super Duper Love type of record.
Yeah.
They might play it and they might think, oh my God, this is awful, and they throw it out the window. Yeah. But it's okay because there will be more, and next time it will be different again.
Yeah.
And again and again. Yeah. And it's just more fun for me.
Yeah.
I guess that's a selfish thing.
Yeah, no,
but it's just more fun.
Yeah.
You know?
You have to sing what's in your heart.
Yeah.
And that, I always feel for artists. I mean, first of all, let me just back up. Nobody's going to hear anything you sing and throw it out the window. That's not going to happen.
You never know.
It's not going to happen. Trust me. It's a beautiful album, and you'll love it.
Bless you.
But no, I mean that sincerely. But it's, I feel sorry for artists in the sense that it is difficult for fans sometimes to allow artists to grow.
Yeah.
Because they get a sound. There you go. They get stuck. They hear a sound. They want to hear that thing over and over again. Yeah. It makes it difficult for you to grow.
They like what they like.
Yeah.
You know? That's why people, you know, like a certain restaurant and they go there every day. You know, they just like what they like, and that's cool. So. Yeah.
But the food isn't offended. The steak or the spaghetti isn't offended that it tastes the same every day. You have different tastes, though.
But for me.
Yeah, yeah.
I have to be, I have to try to not be too selfish, especially when I'm performing, because there are songs that, like Right to Be Wrong, I will sing that, but I've tried to change it many different ways, that sometimes we do acoustic.
Mm-hmm.
Just because for us, I say us, me and my band as well, they have to play this stuff every day, you know, so we, as a unit, as one being, as one feeling, we have to feel good about what we're doing.
Right.
But we mustn't take that away from the listener because we're making it for that listener.
Yeah.
So we don't want to be too selfish and be like, right, now it's going to be fusion jazz.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like, you got to hold on to it a little bit, you know, and give them what they want. But hey, if you like those songs from far in my past, go and play those songs because they're still there.
Yeah.
They're right there.
Yeah.
You know, they're not going anywhere.
Yeah.
So, but if you like to, I don't know, listen to new stuff and be moved around a lot, I don't know. I just enjoy this.
Yeah, well, you should. I was asking Joss about this cover, and you were telling me a fascinating story about how the artwork for this project came to be. Tell me the story.
So, on our Facebook page, we decided to involve the fans in making this record. So, a lot of the time, I have had, like, a very clear kind of image in my mind what I want my album to look like.
Right.
And I won't be swayed and all this, but this time I just felt like, you know what, this is all about involving lots of different people, lots of different musicians and sounds and ideas and being creative. And I thought, let me just open up the floor to all of the artists out there if you want to have a go. So I told them a little bit about what the sound is and what the feeling is and why I made the record. And then we got hundreds and hundreds of pieces of artwork. It was beautiful, and it was so nice to see how people kind of see and hear what it is that I'm trying to do. So this lady, man, she really captured what I want to be. Like, I would like to be that lady, you know,
she looks like, I don't know, ethereal, like fairy-like and free and pensive.
She definitely looks free, yeah.
Yeah. And the colors are nice. It's very, like, earthy. So it was hard to choose, but it was a nice thing
that's
to get
a really, that's
involved.
A really cool thing, though, to let your fans submit artwork that you use for your project.
Yeah, it was fun.
Wow. She must be very happy.
Yeah. I think she is. Yeah, she is.
What country is she from?
She's from England.
From England?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, wow. And the title, Water for Your Soul. Why that title for this project?
So, yeah, so Water for Your Soul is really, it's a title from a song that I wrote way before we met Damien and all that. Mm-hmm. I was driving along in Europe and I was getting a bit moody. Mm-hmm. I don't know what was up with me. Well, I do now, but at the time I was like, I just feel not right. I just feel really irritable, really annoyed. Mm-hmm. And my ex, he said to me, just go write a song or something. And in that moment, I realized, that's why I'm moody, because I haven't fed myself or watered myself properly. I feel like not right. And then I wrote a song called Water for Your Soul, which is a bonus, I think, because it like sonically didn't fit with the rest of the album. Mm-hmm. It's like real glitchy and different. But the title explains everything about me and why I do what I want to do. Mm-hmm. You must water yourself. You must give yourself the opportunity to stand upright, allow yourself to grow and feel good. Mm. And for me, it's music and being creative, but for someone else, it might be anything. It could be doing mathematical equations every morning. Mm-hmm. You know, we're all different. Mm. So figure that out. What is that thing? And then water yourself.
I love it. Yeah. Water for your soul. Now you know what it means, and if you go pick it up, you can hear what it sounds like. And it's a wonderful project. Vinyl, CD, she's got it all. It's called Water for Your Soul, the new project from Joss Stone, the third project on her own label. And it's a lovely thing, and it'll make you feel good when you put it on. Joss, always glad to have you on this program.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming to see us, sweet.
Oh, thank you so much.
Take care. You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Tony Marcano is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.